This episode is brought to you by Mubi, a curated streaming service dedicated to elevating great cinema from around the globe. From iconic directors to emerging auteurs, there was always something new to discover. With Mubi, each and every film is hand-selected, so you can explore the best of cinema, streaming anytime, anywhere. Like Pavements, Alex Ross Perry's rockumentary biopic hybrid about the only band that matters, Pavement. Starring members of the band, as well as Joe Keery, Jason Schwartzman, and Tim Heidecker, the wildly original picture tackles the mythology of the band, their anticipated comeback, and more in a fashion that matches their left-field ethos. To stream Pavements and other great films, you can try Mubi free for 30 days at mubi.com/COS. That's mubi.com/COS for a month of great cinema for free.
Hey everybody, this is Aaron Carnes, the host of this podcast. After 4.5 years of weekly episodes, we are ready to stop creating In Defense of Ska. The podcast was meant to be a promotional push for my book In Defense of Ska, and it wound up taking on a life of its own. While Adam and I both love what we've accomplished with this podcast, we both feel compelled to focus our creative output elsewhere. The episodes we recorded remain evergreen, and we invite you to explore our back catalog, which will remain online thanks to the Consequence Podcast Network. I am working diligently on a new book, a novel called Little Black Book of Death. It's not ska-related, but it has a strong musical component. I also have a punk-themed script in the works. Adam is working on new music for Omnigon. We invite you to follow our respective projects and look forward to what the future holds. To keep in touch with my writing, follow me on Substack. That's aaroncarnes.substack.com. You can follow Omnigon on their social media accounts. Thank you.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Welcome to In Defense of Ska. We aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of the music. Ska deserves the respect genres like punk, hip-hop, and hardcore find among their listeners. Our host is renowned music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska, Aaron Carnes.
Today we talk about the band The Planet Smashers and the label Stomp Records. At the center of both of these is Matt Collier, our guest today. He formed The Planet Smashers in 1993. Frustrated that no label wanted to release his band's music, he joined forces with Jordan Swift of the Kingpins to form Stomp Records with the intention of releasing a split record with both of their bands. Stomp Records has released several iconic Canadian groups, including Bedouin Soundclash and The Flatliners. They also worked with bands outside of Canada. The Planet Smashers would go on to be one of Canada's biggest ska bands, and they toured the U.S. a lot. We go deep this week on The Planet Smashers and Stomp Records. In the process, we learn a little bit about how Canada's ska scene has been different from the U.S. ska scene. And now joining me is my co-host, veteran ska musician Adam Davis, who's been in many bands, including Link 80 and Omnigon.
So Link 80 toured with The Planet Smashers back in the day on a run through Canada. Mm-hmm. And I brought it up to Matt, I think before we were recording, and he had no memory of us touring together.
Seems like an unlikely pair to me.
Yeah. Planet Smashers and Link 80, I think, are probably at two opposite ends of the ska punk spectrum. The funny thing though, is I reconnected with Matt at a Half Past Two show in San Diego. Mm. They were coming down to play with Half Past Two, and I just happened to be in town, so I stopped by the show.
Very cool. Do you guys share a beer?
No.
So I feel like we probably should have had Matt on earlier, because Stomp Records has been pretty important. You know, Planet Smashers is an important band, but so is Stomp. We've already done episodes with Bedouin Soundclash and Flatliners, who were pretty key bands to
the early 2000s era of Planet Smashers. We get into that in this episode. And I feel like there's probably a good case to be made for the success of these bands and the continued success of Stomp Records.
Yeah, I think you're right there.
And also, I mean, we also talk about there's parallels between Moon Ska and Stomp Records, but we can really see in this conversation the different paths they go and why Stomp is still a label and Moon is no longer a label.
Yeah, running a label is hard work.
Yeah, it is. So Planet Smashers are playing Supernova this year, September 13th through 15th. They've done a lot of U.S. touring. I think they have, it's slowed down a bit, but they're back and you got to go see them at Supernova. Go to supernovaska.com. Get your tickets. A lot of other cool bands are playing too.
So Stomp Records and the Planet Smashers story illustrates that even though ska's popularity went down in the 2000s, it didn't crash and burn and become super embarrassing to be affiliated with like it was here in the U.S.
All right, so first question is a Stomp Records question. Is your most successful record you've ever released, is it Bedouin Sound Clash's Sounding a Mosaic?
Oh, absolutely.
That's what I thought.
Oh, yeah, that album did great for us. Up here it went platinum and then a little bit more, just kept on going. It was really exciting. We were getting close to calling it. I mean, we were coming out of we're in the middle of the death of ska, you know, like it was, Moon was gone. We were dangling. And that year we had a bunch of really good releases. I think it was 2004 by the end of it, maybe five. And that year we had Bedouin. Flatliners came out mm-hmm. the same year. Smashers had an album and we had a punk rock band called Belvedere do really well as well. So it was a very good year.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. I want to get into this because I think Stomp and Planet Smashers both have an interesting story in terms of not only surviving the death, the fall of ska, but thriving in it.
Yeah.
So this is part of that story. So let's talk about Bedouin Sound Clash first. So as I understand it, a Montreal Gazette writer dropped off their Root Fire record at your office or something?
Yeah, he was a really awesome guy. He was a very good, like he would always come by. He lived in the neighborhood. He had this great Portuguese chicken place around the corner. He'd come by and eat Portuguese chicken. And then one day he was down in Kingston. His girlfriend, oh my gosh, I can't remember the name of her, but we toured the Aquabats. Anyway, that's a whole nother story. His girlfriend had played with Bedouin in Kingston for some university thing. And he came back with this demo, which was actually Root Fire at the time. I mean, it wasn't fully mastered, but it was their first independent release. And I just wrote Jay, went down and saw him, and things worked out. You know, like he was kind of funny. He's like, oh man, now I've signed to a record label, so where's all the money? Like, oh no, not quite. But we hit it off. I mean, It was truly exciting. And, we put Root Fire at first and then we slowly worked towards Sounding a Mosaic. That album was so cheap. We did it on the super cheap at this independent studio just around the corner from where Stomp was.
How cheap?
Oh, it was like $6,000-$7,000. And back then that was cheap. Like now that's quite a lot.
Yeah.
But back then you couldn't do anything without, you know, a proper studio. So,
yeah.
But Daryl Jennifer from Bad Brains produced that record, right?
Yep. He came up and he stayed at a buddy of ours' place. Padge Williams at the time was the band's manager. He stayed at his place. Padge runs concert production here for Evenco and stuff like that. So it was really something. Daryl Jennifer in the studio. I was kind of like, when he was around, I was sort of little starstruck, you know. I didn't know what to say around him. I just kind of kept quiet.
Were you a big Bad Brains fan?
Yeah. I mean, I I used to skate.
That explains it.
Yeah, it didn't work out. But Daryl did great. He actually did the next one too. But that relationship, that we were out of it by then. So, but that album came out right around 2000, I think it was May 20, 2005. Mm-hmm. And we lucked out. There was a retail whatever, like a Kmart, like a Walmart back then, but it was called Zellers. I don't know if that was ever in the States. No. They decided to use When the Night Feels My Song on one of their commercials, and it went crazy because of that. You know, we were probably 4 months into the release. We just signed with Warner for distribution, and we thought we had it all, you know, but we needed that Zellers thing to really push it over, which kind of sounds shitty, but that's really what really got it going, you know?
Yeah. I mean, with a lot of songs, that's the thing that ends up getting ears on it.
Yeah. And like, you know, back, I think Brent, Apple was a big deal, you know, with their music, pushing their music back then. You know, that's probably how Feist got discovered with the 1, 2, 3, 4. I only know the Sesame Street version of that song. I can't remember the real version, but anyway.
So in the States, Bedouin have played a fair amount in the States, but they're not a big band here. And when the night feels my song is not a hit here. So can you kind of explain to people in the US what that song and that band, their legacy, what the legacy of this song and that band is in Canada?
It's really special because I feel like almost every year there's one or two bizarre sounding songs that becomes a commercial hit, you know, and this was one of them. They had something that it was very organic. It was very lo-fi, but beautiful at the same time. Hey, beautiful day. Hey, beautiful day. Canada embraced it. It was, you know, at the same time we had, you know, straight pop stuff that was happening that was dominating the charts, but they shot up to number one. They won a Juno for it, which is the Canadian version of the Oscars, or not Oscars,
Grammys.
Rain's freezing. Grammy. Thank you. The Grammys. and it was a hit. Like, you would be sitting out having a coffee and some construction truck would come by and they'd be playing When the Night. And the guy's singing it. The dump truck goes by. They're singing it. You know, everywhere you go by, people all over the place were into this tune. And their subsequent singles did well too. But that song really was, you know, like if you did like a top 50 of 2000 in Canada, that would be one of them for sure. Mm-hmm. So it was really something. And they changed a lot of people's, the way they viewed things in Canada, because until then, you know, a lot of the charts were being dominated by the mini majors up here. You know, we had a lot of pop punk going off the rails, and it was doing, I'm no disrespect to the pop punk, but they had the major label support. So Bedouin coming in and doing something completely different with nothing really, you know, up here we had Blink 182 pushing the pop punk scene in Canada. There was nothing like that. No band equivalent to Bedouin helping them out. So they really did it all on their own.
Amazing.
It's kind of nice. Yeah. It's a great story. And, you know, Jay and the guy and Eon, I fell out of touch with Pat, but those guys, man, we're still buds. They're doing their 30th anniversary of that. Wait, my brain's not working right. 20th anniversary of that album this December. And they asked us to play, but we can't do it. So.
Boo.
Oh, bummer.
Boo.
What's the scheduling conflict? Is it something we can ask? Or
it's just, I have another show booked. Oh. So we're gonna do it. Flatliners are also doing the 20th anniversary of their album too. That came out at that same time. And they asked us as well, Destroy to Create. They're going to redo that as well. I think Catbite is going to do them with them. So yeah. That's super cool.
Excellent.
I think Catch 22 might've got it as well.
Yeah. Give us a sense of how big Destroy to Create was. I think it did pretty well in the States, and Flatliners do well here.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't have the grace of Zellers pushing it, you know. So, and also it was pretty rough, you know, it was pretty wild. These guys were, I think they might have been 17 when that album came out. It was awesome. Like it flipped the table up here for a bit. And we knew, like, I remember sitting there at Warped Tour in Toronto and the album's doing well. I'm like, okay, guys, there's only so much we can do for you. You know, we're never going to break you in the States. Let's go hang out in the Less Than Jake bus. So that's how it started. They got into that. And then I guess they met Fat Mike that afternoon. And then some other people helped him out and got him signed to Fat. It was really something. I feel like I had something to do with it, but no, I just was like, I think you should go talk to some people from FAT because
nudge them in the right direction.
Yeah, we're not going to break you. But that was also very exciting because they were so young, and you know, at that Warped Tour, Chris's dad, it was like a part time pilot, like, you know, whatever, like a hobby pilot, you know, like he had his little Cessna that he would rent out occasionally. But anyway, Chris forgot his guitar. And there he's at Warped Tour, and it's like, I don't know, hour and a half before his set, and his dad flies up to the local airport in the Cessna with the guitar and drops it off for him. So he had the support of the family, which is really something special. I'm sure he would, you know, elaborate on that a fair bit. But it was just nice to see different kind of support, and also you know, a great band, and they're still going strong. It's nice to see.
Yeah.
And they're kind of jumping on the ska bus this year. So, because they're redoing Destroy to Create.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, Chris did our show, was it last year or the year before? So,
yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to assume that's the catalyst.
We pushed him over the edge?
Yeah, of course. Obviously. I mean, come on, man.
You know, the funny thing is, I had never heard Destroy to Create until we had him on the podcast. And it's something that I would have loved back in the day.
It would have really, you guys at the Link 80 should have been playing with them all the time.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, it would have been perfect. Oops.
So with the Planet Smashers, you know, you'd been a band since the mid 90s, but your record Unstoppable from, I think, 2005, the same era that we're talking about, was that record bigger than your previous records in terms of sales and stuff?
No. It's our biggest in the States because we started touring more down there around.
It's
that
biggest
time.
In the States.
Yeah. Okay. I would even say worldwide, but Life of the Party up here was out of control.
That's the big one.
It was 99 and it did really well. That's what really got us going as a record label.
Your song Unstoppable is by far your most streamed song.
Yeah, I know. I mean, but that's Spotify. They just decide things.
So there's no like logic to it from what you can tell.
No, it wasn't even in her set until a little while ago. We're like, I was like, oh, what's this Spotify? Spotify told me that I discovered it. It was about a year ago, but it told me that I discovered Spotify a year ago. I'm like, okay, my God, I'm really got to get caught up on this. But yeah, that's embarrassing. But checked it out and we're like, oh man, we should probably play that song. So we've only been playing that one in the set. It was in, you know, for a while. It just kind of fell out of the set. But we brought it back in about 5 years ago. And now it's not going anywhere. We enjoy playing it. It's a good time, especially right now.
And so that record though was produced or Jay worked on it in some capacity from a Bedouin?
Yep. Jay came in. He sings on a song on that one. I got the guys from Big D on it. Mm. Chris Murray produced it. That was his third that he did for us. It was our last real heavy duty studio recording where we were in studio for like 3 weeks, just hanging out, eating Timbits. No. All right.
Wait, what's that? I don't know what that is.
It's Tim Hortons. It's a small version of it. Like a Dunkin' Donut circle, you know, like it's just the inside of the donut.
Oh yeah. The donut hole. Yeah.
Donut hole. Yeah. Tim Hortons called it a Timbit.
That's disgusting. Yeah. That's a terrible name. Why do they call it that?
Gets even worse when you get the jelly filled Timbits.
Oh wow.
Next time you come up, I know what I'm bringing you.
the jelly filled Timbits are on you.
Yeah, that's great. That's nice. But yeah, it was a big album for us too, you know. And stop, that was when we were doing the Ska's Dead tours with all the likes of the bands that are still playing, you know, Catch and Muster Plug and Big D and Voodoo and Toasters. Yeah, it's really fun. We were first of four, sometimes second of five, getting paid $150. And we loved it, man. It was great. It's a total party.
How were those shows? I always wondered. I saw you guys out doing them and I was a little jealous.
It was really, it was special. It's my favorite touring I've ever done because
okay.
We became a little family. Like, I mean, I remember just, you know, every night it was about four or five shows in each band's sort of prime market. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these shows afterwards, you know, not a lot of us didn't have money for hotels. We would just go back to whichever band was kind of hosting that sort of geographical area at the time. And we just go crash at their place. I mean, I spent quite a few nights back then his name was Matt, the bass player from Muster Plug. We stayed at his place a couple nights in Grosse Pointe. I was trying to think, and just outside of Detroit. So there was these moments where we just there was so much hanging out, and also the shows were great. Everyone was blown away. You know, Cash was doing really well. They had a lot of support where they were going. I mean, they were easily getting 500-600 people a show back then. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I think we had some like 2,000 in Worcester. Montreal was over 1,800. Toronto was like 1,400. And these are bands that traditionally, you know, do 500-600 tickets in their market. But teaming up, we made it into something special, and it worked. So it was a really good time.
Hell yeah.
I drank a lot.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
This episode is brought to you by Mubi, a curated streaming service dedicated to elevating great cinema from around the globe. From iconic directors to emerging auteurs, there was always something new to discover. With Mubi, each and every film is hand-selected, so you can explore the best of cinema, streaming anytime, anywhere. Like Pavements, Alex Ross Perry's rockumentary biopic hybrid about the only band that matters, Pavement. Starring members of the band, as well as Joe Keery, Jason Schwartzman, and Tim Heidecker, the wildly original picture tackles the mythology of the band, their anticipated comeback, and more in a fashion that matches their left-field ethos. To stream Pavements and other great films, you can try Mubi free for 30 days at mubi.com/COS. That's mubi.com/COS for a month of great cinema for free.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This episode is brought to you by Mubi, presenting the new film, Lurker. The razor-sharp directorial debut from The Bear and Beef writer-producer Alex Russell, the film follows 20-something Los Angeles retail clerk and loner Matthew, who encounters Oliver, a rising pop star, and takes the opportunity to edge his way into the in-crowd. But staying there isn't easy. Hailed by IndieWire as a transfixing tale of LA obsession gone awry, and by Vogue as one of the best movies of the year, Lurker is an exhilarating take on the music industry, the blurred line between friend and fan, and our universal search for validation. Lurker is now streaming exclusively on Mubi. To stream Lurker and other great films, you can try Mubi for free for 30 days at mubi.com/COS. That's mubi.com/COS for a month of great cinema for free.
I want to go back to the beginning of the band and the label, but before we do that, I want to quickly discuss the four rules for Planet Smashers. Do you know these rules?
They used to be very rigid. I might have let up a bit.
Okay, well let's discuss them. So first rule, and I'm pretty sure this is no longer a rule, but I still want to discuss it. Never wear your own band shirt on stage.
Well, yeah, you're not supposed to do that. but we have jerseys that are our band names are on the back, but we don't sell them. So in theory, yeah, it's gray. You know, it's a gray area.
It's a uniform.
It's a uniform. There you go. We're forced to wear them. We don't have a choice. I think if you have your own choice, then definitely don't wear your own band shirt. Unless it's a long tour and I don't know. I would flip it inside out. That would be my 2 cents.
What's your take, Adam?
I used to be on that same page, but like I kind of like when the band wears the band shirt on stage, especially it feels very thrash metal to me.
It does have a bit of a thrash metal thing.
Like it's definitely something you would have seen like a thrash metal band do. And also if you have a sick shirt design, like rock that shit. I think that's cool. Now, how do you feel about shorts on stage?
Oh, it's disappointing, but sometimes you got to do it.
Some people pull it off, like Mike from Kill Lincoln usually rocks shorts.
Oh yeah, you can do it. I mean,
and I don't hate it.
I mean, like I wish I could pull it off, but I can't. So
yeah, I don't do it.
I look like I'm going to school or something.
Yeah, it's a personal rule for me, but
here's my lunch.
I don't hold other people to it.
That's there you go. It's a good rule.
Yeah.
Okay. Next rule. If you're going to fart in the van, tell people first.
Man, still, I mean, just let them know. I mean, we had a couple of guys that really, I mean, that if anyway, you know, too much Taco Bell. It's mm-hmm. time. You just got to be honest, you know, bring that, we're in the safety nest there in that van. You know, you can't be,
you just got to own it and crack a window.
Yeah, that's it. We have other ones. I want to see if you get to the 3 and 4. I'm curious, but I think I know what they are.
You cannot rhyme desire with fire or monkey with funky.
No funky monkey desire fire. Come on. Come on.
Are those the only lazy rhymes that are you're firmly opposed, or is there any others?
I mean, those are the only one we're firmly opposed, but there are others where we are writing. We're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. No, come on. You can't do that. But then sometimes we just do it, you know? We were a little bit more rigid. Originally, you weren't even allowed to talk about monkeys or coconuts or anything like that, but that crept in. That crept into our tunes. But, yeah, what can you do?
Sometimes you got to write about monkeys and coconuts, yeah, right? Adam, I'm going to flip this on you. Do you have any, when you're writing lyrics, do you ever find yourself wanting to rhyme something and you said, no, I'm not going to do that. It's too lazy.
No, but I mean, usually that, you know, that decision comes really fast and quick and moves on to the next one. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I found works is to take a phrase and kind of Yoda it. So like take it and like take the back half of the sentence and put it at the front half and front half of the back half. Mm. And then you can maybe get a different word that to rhyme against.
Ooh,
so you're not always rhyming you, two, true, blue, Sue. Like you can find some different things if you flip the phrasing of the sentence. That's been my trick lately.
Not bad.
So I'm writing songs right now. I might be just, I'm just writing that one down.
Yeah.
And the other one I found too is because second verse is always real hard, right, Matt? Second verse.
Oh yeah. Second verse. It always goes downhill.
So you just make first verse, second verse, and then you write a new first verse.
Let's see if I can do that.
I like that one too.
Wow, this is educational. All right, so last rule is if you want to be in a punk band, start a new band. The Planet Smashers are a ska band.
Oh yeah, that is true. That's true. I mean, it, you know, as a kid, I was always disappointed with the ska bands that became not ska bands. Now it's a little different. Now I'm like, I'm much more open-minded and I can handle it. But back then I couldn't handle it. I couldn't handle it when Madness stopped being ska. I couldn't handle it when the Specials became whatever they became. It goes on. I mean, it's not just that. I couldn't handle it when the Jam became Northern Soul, I think they call it, or something. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It just sounds not good. So for us, when we started out, we always said that if we're going to start writing punk tunes and or whatever garage tunes, which, you know, we almost did. We originally were a garage band, but we would stop. So Smashers were ska, and that was it. Don't bring in your garage song to the Smasher Jam. That was kind of where we were at. I mean, there's times where we all felt we had something like that, but we would warp it into ska, like literally. Take the tune that doesn't want to be ska and just smush it into a ska box. And sometimes it didn't work and sometimes it really does work. And you can hear that a song like Blind from No Self Control. That song was, you know, it's a punk song that works.
Yeah. I'm of two minds of that thought process. I mean, on one hand, it's like, if I was a solo artist, like whatever I was feeling at that given time would be what I would put out. I mean, it's because that's me. That's what I'm feeling. So I could see.
Yeah, you'd have to change your name.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, exactly. But I mean, a band can do that too. Like this is where the band's at. But at the same time, I see the other point of view, and that's that a band is a collection of people, and a band has a brand element to it, and so some of that is you create what that is, and so there's only so much you can divert from that, what you've created, especially if you've developed a fan base. So it's, I don't know. I could see both sides of it. And I think both, if you continue with a very similar sound or if you change your sound, I think they have to be approached with thoughts, you know, what you have to do it thoughtfully, I think.
Yeah, I would have to agree. And also, you have to also remember that this, you know, we're talking about ska. So, I mean, if I want to be, you know, exploratory in my musical abilities, I don't think I would do it as ska, you know? Mm. I mean, I ska is different. It's energetic. It's entertaining. It's fun. It's brings people together. And that's what I love about it. So that's where that comes from. It's more of that, you know, we started a ska band. We didn't do this to be fancy musicians and stuff like that. You know, we did this for what it is. And that's the beauty of ska music. And so we didn't want to, that's why we really supported that. I think if we'd started out as, you know, as a pop band and then moved into soul and stuff like that, it would be a little different. You know, as you explore your domains and your abilities. But the deal behind us was if you wanted to do that, just be in a different band. And so quite a few of us are in different bands, not me. Cause I'm just, I can only do, that's all I can do.
What other bands are the other guys in?
Andy and Patrizio are in a band called Boyds. It's outstanding. Tom from Sum 41 produced it. It's out, their new album comes out. They have a first single out right now. It's killer. They just don't play very often. You know, it's kind of like a hobby band. They really dig it. Alex, our saxophone player, is in a surf band. Pat doesn't, he used to be another ska band, but now he just works.
Fair enough.
Just works.
Got to pay those bills.
Yeah, bills and bills. He's a good trombone player. Well, he occasionally plays with Big D and occasionally plays with Goldfinger. So that's kind of
fun. Oh, there you go.
He's like a parachute musician, I guess.
Well, let's see. Let's talk about that formation of the band and you making that decision to be a ska band. So before Planet Smashers was ever a thing, your older brother was the person that discovered ska, right? After going to England.
Yeah. Man, where are you getting this from?
He has his ways.
ChatGPT, man. It's finding the goods.
Yeah. And so, tell me if this story is true.
It is.
He grabbed your ELO record, put a firecracker in it and blew it up and made you listen to ska instead.
Pretty much. He'd already ingrained quite a bit of ska into us at that point, but that was it for him. He blew up my ELO record. It was actually, he put some ska on, but then he said, here, listen to this. He put the headphones on. He threw on Bodies by the Sex Pistols, which now isn't really all that, you know, when you actually listen to it, it's all that politically correct. But it's
right. But the energy of it when you're a teenager and you're not thinking about what it's about.
Yeah. And I just thought, holy crap, this guy's swearing. This is nuts. and that really got me hooked on ska music and also punk rock and everything about it. And just the ability to just go do it. You know, you don't have to wait around for someone to take the magic wand and ding you on the shoulder. And that's where that was it. You know, that was the inspiration that really made me realize that I didn't have to rely on others in that way. I mean, I rely on the others in my band and stuff like that, but not the
gatekeepers, if you will.
Yeah, yeah, the gatekeepers.
Which ELO record got destroyed?
I don't remember the name, but it has Don't Bring Me Down on it. So it was after Xanadu, I think. Okay. Don't Bring Me Down. Woo, Bruce. Yeah. Something like that. I love that song. Still.
So yes, that is one of the most famous misheard lyrics.
Yeah, that Bruce.
It's gross. Gross.
Oh, gross? Gross. Yeah.
But everyone thinks it's Bruce.
Well, that makes more sense.
Yeah.
If you think about it.
My friend's dad was, you know, like a young man in the 70s, and his name was Bruce, and he got teased ruthlessly with that song. People would sing that song at him. But little did they know. They got the lyrics wrong.
Well, you should have flicked his boogers at them, and then he would have owned the lyric lease. But, yeah, so that's it. He left a prep. He came back a mod and a rude boy, and he basically beat ska into me. And then it came out in the form of silliness.
Okay, so before you formed Planet Smashers, let's talk a little bit about the state of ska in Canada. King Apparatus, probably the biggest, most important ska band up to that point.
Absolutely. And there was another band from Montreal called Me, Mom, and Morgenthaler. Morgenthaler was the first doctor in Canada to allow, well, not to allow, to do abortions for people. At first it was illegal, but that's where that inspiration came from. They were pretty, pretty out there politically. And it was nice to see. They had a lot of, they were challenging a lot of people back then. That band in Montreal and King App, that was it. There was a couple other bands, but those were the two bands that were doing things. I remember going to the Let's Go Bowling show with King Apparatus. And I went with my bass player at the time, and we were in the garage band, the Planet Smashers garage up until then. And we saw Let's Go Bowling on stage, and then Chris Murray and Mitch from King App crushing it. And then there was a little bit of a neo-Nazi in the crowd doing some salutations. And this is what did it for us. So we saw all the guys from Let's Go Bowling got on stage, and Chris went right up, and they just literally bounced the guy right out of the room. We had a lot of problems in Montreal in 94, 95, 96, even right through about 98 with the neo-Nazis. We were constantly getting beaten up.
Jeez.
I remember getting kicked in the head just thinking, oh, I thought it would hurt more.
Wasn't too bad?
Wasn't so bad. You know, I didn't get my teeth. You know?
Yeah. As long as you don't get the teeth or nose.
Yeah, just keep that out. There was four guys, and I got a poutine, just an innocent poutine after the show, and I had like a anti-racist action shirt on. It was Calvin from Calvin and Hobbes smashing a swastika.
Yeah,
pretty harmless, but they didn't like it, and they followed me out and just
four on one.
Oh yeah, and I had these parade, you know those parade boots, like the army surplus combat boots, but they're called parade boots. So they have absolutely no treads. And it was February in Montreal, so it's ice everywhere. I was that sound, I can't do it, but you know, in the cartoons, that sound
fell right in my ass. Yeah.
And I don't even think they touched me before I was down, because I was trying to get out of there, trying to get back up. And then they just started hoofing me. But, I was okay. A taxi and an ambulance came whipping by and scared them off.
I'm curious, as a band from Montreal, in this time period, what your understanding of Propagandhi's song "Ska Sucks" was, and where that song came from.
I mean, it didn't really get to Montreal that quickly. I'll be honest. It took some time for that song to get to us. And I imagine, I don't even know when that was written. When did that come out?
It was written in, I believe, first written in like the early 90s or late 80s. And it wasn't really distributed wildly until their first record on Fat Records, which I think was like 93 or something. But, or could have been 94. I can't remember exactly. But the song was about the Nazi problem in Winnipeg. And I don't know if that was something that was totally lost here. I don't know if that was something that you guys were aware of or not.
I've never known that, but I can believe it, because we did have a lot of problems, right? You know, there was a lot of anti-racist action was a thing we really needed up here at the time. You know, we had a lot of problems.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, I didn't know that, but that's nice.
It got a little lost when it was put out on their Fat Records album, and ska was starting to blow up, you know.
Well, the timing was good for them.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
I want to go back to King Apparatus real quick, because I want to kind of understand. So they started to do pretty well in the U.S., but then they broke up. But they were doing... You know, they were doing Canada obviously before that. And didn't they have a single on the radio?
Oh yeah, it was massive. I think it was about 91, maybe 90.
What was the song again? I can't remember.
Made for TV.
Made for TV, that's right. Yeah, so that song was on the radio.
It was everywhere. Well, not everywhere. It was everywhere in parts of Canada. So in Toronto, it was absolutely massive. Vancouver, massive. Montreal didn't really have alternative radio at the time. We only had the college stations. So you could find it. And that's how I got into it. I was living in Montreal at the time. And it came out. And I was like, holy cow, finally. You know, back then, there wasn't a lot wasn't much ska music reaching Montreal at the time. So for me, it was pretty exciting. And then also with Meemaw and Morgenthaler doing well too, it's kind of nice. A little ska boom.
From your point of view, you understood it was ska since you were already into two-tone. Was it presented that way? Did most people who heard on the radio have any context for what it was?
Oh, absolutely. They were going full on that this is a ska revival, effectively. You know, you could call it that. But I mean, with King Apparatus, they had such a two-tone feel to them because there's very few horns in their music. Guitar-driven riffs. You know, so it was more two-tone in terms of where you would put it. It's definitely not third wave. And that kind of gave them a bit of respectability, I would say, right off the bat, just because it came out from the, you know, they're on the shoulders of the two-tone greats. And the big station in Toronto at the time, alternative station, was very leading in that format. You know, they had played the Specials before anybody was playing the Specials, and they played, you know, the Clash before anyone played the Clash, et cetera, right through. So whenever something new and exciting came from the subgenres, they would focus on it, whether it was hardcore or what, but they would just go with it. So
when did Planet Smashers form then? And then who started it?
I started it. We were kicking around as a garage four piece, probably as early as 93, but we were terrible. I mean, we were pretty bad. Although we did cover Op Ivy Unity at the time, and people thought it was our song. And this guy always said, this is another rule he always said, never, if you play a cover and they think it's yours, just go with it. So he's this guy that tells me this. He was the lead singer of a band called The Gruesomes, a garage band. And eventually he was in a ska band too. But he came up to me after the show. He's like, holy crap, that song, Stop This War, it's so good. I'm like, yeah, I know, man. You like it? He's like, yeah, it's a real anthem. I'm like, thanks. Because Operation Ivy wasn't a thing yet. You couldn't find it anywhere. You couldn't find energy anywhere. And then maybe 3 or 4 months later, it switched over. Everyone had it. And yeah. He came up. He's like, you dick. So it's pretty good. But eventually we realized, you know, garage is fun, but ska music made people dance. And we, you know, switched over. There was a six-piece version of the band probably in 94. I was playing sax at the time. Alto. Alto sax. And some early versions of tunes that eventually did get recorded by what was the real Planet Smashers were written.
How are you on the alto sax?
Oh, I'm terrible. It's up in my closet. I don't think I could probably squeak out a few notes.
I have an alto in my closet too. I don't play, but we're both too tall to be playing alto sax.
Yeah, that, we should do a little two-tone, a little duet.
Sure.
Don't play alto sax. Reason.
Not if you're over 6 foot. Okay.
Yep, that's it.
We're going to add to the Planet Smasher rules on this episode.
I think so. It should be on there.
Just alto don't. Sax, nobody can play it if you're over 6 foot. You have to switch to Barry.
That's it.
Anybody can play tenor.
Well, yeah, I mean, come on.
how tall do you need to be to play the Barry?
Oh, it doesn't matter. I'm just saying, like the fingering is similar or the same, I think, for alto and Barry. So like if you're over 6 foot, you have to switch to Barry.
Okay.
That's a good rule.
Yeah.
Be right back after this.
This episode is brought to you by Mubi, a curated streaming service dedicated to elevating great cinema from around the globe. From iconic directors to emerging auteurs, there was always something new to discover. With Mubi, each and every film is hand-selected, so you can explore the best of cinema, streaming anytime, anywhere. Like Pavements, Alex Ross Perry's rockumentary biopic hybrid about the only band that matters, Pavement. Starring members of the band, as well as Joe Keery, Jason Schwartzman, and Tim Heidecker, the wildly original picture tackles the mythology of the band, their anticipated comeback, and more in a fashion that matches their left-field ethos. To stream Pavements and other great films, you can try Mubi free for 30 days at mubi.com/COS. That's mubi.com/COS for a month of great cinema for free. This episode is brought to you by Mubi, presenting the new film, Lurker. The razor-sharp directorial debut from The Bear and Beef writer-producer Alex Russell, the film follows 20-something Los Angeles retail clerk and loner Matthew, who encounters Oliver, a rising pop star, and takes the opportunity to edge his way into the in-crowd. But staying there isn't easy. hailed by IndieWire as a transfixing tale of LA obsession gone awry, and by Vogue as one of the best movies of the year, Lurker is an exhilarating take on the music industry, the blurred line between friend and fan, and our universal search for validation. Lurker is now streaming exclusively on Mubi. To stream Lurker and other great films, you can try Mubi for free for 30 days at mubi.com/COS. That's mubi.com/COS for a month of great cinema for free.
Stomp Records was a thing you started just to kind of, because you couldn't get anyone to release Planet Smashers, essentially, right?
That's it. I sent it to the first demo. I sent it to Riot Energy, which was King Apparatus's label at the time. They never wrote me back.
Yeah, this wasn't a ska label per se, right? This was a mostly punk label that also released King Apparatus.
Yep, that's it. And in Montreal, the other label was called Cooch Records, which was just a Mima Moritaler thing. They just did that. So we had to do our own thing.
You and Jordan Swift from the Kingpins.
That's it.
You guys were equal partners in this?
Yeah. We started out, both of us had young ska bands that were starting to do well that had recorded some music and we didn't know how to put it out. So we're like, let's just make a record label. His address was on the back of the first releases and my phone number, my home phone number was on the back of the first releases.
I love the 90s. I remember my demo tapes had my parents' phone number on it. Just so crazy to think about now.
Yeah.
I actually got a phone call from Mark from BYO, Youth Brigade. He calls me up in 95. Says, hey, man, it's Mark. Yeah? From Youth Brigade. I'm like, holy, how did you get my number? He's like, it's on the back of this comp. It's the only time I ever talked to him on the phone.
Well, and then what were you going to say regarding Matt, Moon Records, Matt?
Okay, well, Moon was doing very well. And we were like, what can we be called? And of course, Moonstomp. So there it is.
Stomp. All right.
Stomp Records. And we modeled ourselves at first after Moon for a long time. We were trying to do what they were trying to do, which was brand ska and really push ska music. And then present new bands that played ska and expect it, you know, effectively to work. Mm-hmm. It did for a while.
So you started with, it was going to be originally a split single between you and between Planet Smashers and Kingpins, but that kind of morphed into the Scandinavian Club Volume 1 comp.
Yeah, that's it. That's exactly what happened. It was a slow process, you know, like we found a few other bands in Montreal that we didn't know were playing ska, which mm-hmm. is ironic because you think you would know. And then they do some band in Winnipeg. And then we slowly started branching out. And I remember calling a buddy going to school in Vancouver. And I was like, hey, man, I know you're not into ska, but can you just check to see if there's any ska bands in your town? Because you couldn't find out, you know, you didn't know. And he went out to a couple ska shows in Vancouver and actually discovered a few bands that otherwise wouldn't have been on that comp. Then it just kind of spread word of mouth. You know, we'd get the demos. Little dat tapes. It was dat tapes by then. Oh, maybe it wasn't. No, it was. It was dat tapes by then. And, but they mailed them in. Everyone had lyrics that were printed on, written on a piece of paper, mailed to us. It was a different time.
Yeah.
You made a CD and you sold 10,000 with doing nothing. It's so crazy.
It's wild.
And we were lucky. Our timing was perfect. It was 95. It was right when Outcome the Wolves came out and, Offspring were huge and, you know, Boston's was just about to become a household name, you know, in a couple of years later, I guess. So the timing was right.
Yeah. So you got distribution with Cargo. Yeah. Can you explain what all that was and how that worked as a label? You know, you don't know anybody or you don't have any connections, I assume, but how does all this happen?
It was Cargo was the main independent distributor. They had all the Epitaph stuff and Fatten. They were doing very well, specifically with those two albums, Smash from Offspring and Outcome the Wolves from Rancid. So they were doing very well. A lot of musicians in the scene in Montreal worked for them. I didn't have a contact. There's a street punk band. They're still around. They're called the Ripcords. And actually I don't know, they're really something. They're an institution here, but they never really broke out of Canada. Paul Gott from the Ripcord said, hey, you should go talk to this guy, Gubby, and ask him if he'll put out your, distribute your comp. I went up. He's a long-haired metal dude. He's like, Scott, yeah, of course. He totally got it right away.
Nice.
Just like, let's do it. He now actually works in California for Cobra Side distribution. So he moved along. But that's how it was. He got our albums into market, and we didn't know what we were doing. We just took out some ads here and there, and you know, we used tape to make the ad. You know, you cut little pieces of paper out and put the make little ransom notes, it all worked. So it was nice.
How well did Scanadian Club Volume 1 do?
Up here, it sold about 17,000 copies, which is pretty good when you think we're 1/10 the population of America.
Yeah, because I guess this is the first like compilation to sort of highlight Canadian ska bands, right?
Yeah, that's what it was. So we had our kind of own little isolated ska boom up here. It was a little different, you know. Toasters, we knew about them, but didn't really know about them. So it was a little. We were a little isolated at first, which was kind of nice. Gave us some space.
Who all was on that comp that American audiences might not know?
Well, King App was on it. King Apparatus they put a song on it. Smashers were on it, obviously. Kingpins. Trying to think of any band that you might know. A band called Scavenger from Regina. Most of them are long gone. Pressure Cooker.
Pressure Cooker's from Victoria, right?
Yep, they were from Victoria. Good band. Scarface from Toronto. Mobster Syndicate from Montreal. It was Gangster Politics, which eventually those guys went on to become Patrick Watson. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he's...
So Patrick Watson.
Yep.
He puts out this sort of like ethereal, like piano indie pop music.
Outstanding musician.
Oh, it's amazing. So, but he was in this ska band.
There was no off switch on him. You couldn't. He just was on all the time. He was really something. There was a few guys like that. We had, it was a punk band. It was Reset. Reset was on our label too, and they became Simple Plan. Patrick Watson out of Gangster Politics. There was a band called The Undercovers. They became The Stills. Mm-hmm. Who did pretty well about 10, 15 years ago. They had some stuff on Vice Records. So, you know, it was kind of cool to see those alumni move out of their ska world. And they stopped their ska band, and then they went on and did new stuff and did well. They followed the rule.
How does Patrick Watson feel about his ska past, to your knowledge?
I don't think he fully acknowledges it. I think he would probably laugh about it.
Okay.
He was, you know, it was very, we were wild back then. It was, you know, that was like 97 and everyone's, you know, living in the bars and spending every penny they have drinking, listening to ska music and discovering the old school ska music that we didn't really know about. And he was into it. He would be out all the time. He played keyboards and keys on Life of the Party for us. And that was the beginning of his sort of exit from ska. Like, he did a bit more, maybe about a year or two later he started his own thing.
Well, if you bump into him, let him know that he should come do our show and talk about his ska past.
Okay, I'm going to. He just did an interview a little while ago. I do see him around occasionally,
and okay,
definitely some of his music.
Yeah, because I am a Patrick Watson fan, so I would love to connect Patrick Watson in the present to his ska past.
He would probably think it's, yeah, I'll work on him.
Let's do
him.
It. Yeah.
Okay, cool. That'd be really good. I'd listen to that. So, yeah, I'm just randomly telling stories of what was happening up here. It was, like I said, it was very exciting. I mean, everyone was coming out to the shows. Everyone was into it. Everyone was a rude girl, rude boy. The Montreal punk scene, ska scene was cool. It was really good. Everyone's showing up in Vespas. Everyone's showing up in two-tone suits and this and that. It was really something.
Now, I read in an interview you talking about Montreal specifically having a particularly vibrant ska scene.
Yeah.
And that, like, you suggested that it might even be one of the biggest in North America, just because how much people loved the ska party.
It's still there. I mean,
yeah. So yeah, let's talk about this a little bit.
Right now, I would say Montreal's a little behind now because of ska being popular elsewhere. I mean, look, it's more popular in certain areas than it was before. In Montreal, it never waned. It was always popular. But you know, right now I would say areas of the States have more interest, more people focused on supporting ska music than in Montreal. But the scene's still really good.
When did you really start to see it blow up in Montreal?
Oh, as a fan going to the Meemaw Morgenthaler shows back in 91.
You know, oh, okay. Wow. Okay.
Oh, yeah. It was always like there would be 1,000 people at their shows every time they played. So it's always good. But for me personally, it would be, I mean, we do shows, unknown band with no recorded music. It's not a big deal. You get a couple hundred people out, you know, tickets are $4 or something to get in. And the scene started growing out of that. By 97, it was these four or five Montreal bands that were nothing before, you know, and had no real support other than the dummy, the phony label Stomp Records. Started doing really, it was a shell record. I mean, like there was no one really worked there. all the shows were, you know, they were doing great. 1,000 people here and there, a lot of loft shows, a lot of like just, you know, not a standard show club, like, or what do you want to call it? Just like house parties all over the place. Yeah.
When did you feel like Planet Smashers were kind of blowing up past just that you were a ska band and Montreal loves ska? Was it Life of the Party?
Life of the Party really did it. We would go out on the road a lot. We were one of the only bands that toured nationally consistently. We would go out a lot. And then when Life of the Party came out, quite a few stations, including the one that supported King Apparatus, you know, about 8 years earlier, played our music. So we had some commercial success, you could say.
Okay. So Life of the Party was released in 1999.
Yep.
What song or songs were played on the radio?
Life of the Party. Surfing in Tofino. And Too Much Attitude. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. She got too much attitude. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. All right. Too much attitude. Too Much Attitude got played on a lot of the less modern rock stations, but Life of the Party, and then was played a lot in the East, and then Surfing in Tofino out West.
Would you say that of those three songs, one of them is like your most known song, or does it really depend on where you're at?
I think it really depends on where we're at. But those three plus Super Orgy Porno Party at the end of the album, which we didn't think we'd even put on. We're like, well, this is a dumb song. Let's put it like late in the album. Now we can't play it. We can't play a show without people forcing us to play it. You know, that one does really well too, but it was never played on the radio. Back then you couldn't.
Yeah.
You weren't allowed. It's forbidden.
Surfing in Tofino, that song you wrote about your brother, the same brother that forced you into ska?
Nope. Different, the middle brother.
Oh, different brother. Okay.
Yeah. He had a different, he was a prep in school. He went to England on the same class trip and came back a mod. So brother one came back a rude boy, not quite skinhead, but rude boy punk. And the other one came back a mod. So they also, he affected me as well, but that was his jam, upbringing, I guess you could say. I wasn't going to say downbringing, but he had a lot to do with, you know, me growing up and becoming, I guess what you could say is, you know, someone who fits the punk mold pretty well. Not just the idea of doing it and just like going for it and not sitting around waiting for someone to help you out and not listening to what other people were telling you was possible, you know? So he had his little role. He moved out to Tofino. He was in last year university and he renoed my parents' cottage, the family cottage. My mom said, I'll never sell it, son. I'll never sell it if you put it in a washing machine. So he dug a 4-foot trench all the way down the hill through clay. I mean, this is a serious undertaking. A week later, my parents sold the cottage. He stole the car. He stole their family car and drove out west and lived in a van for like 4 years out in Tofino before it was popular. And I went to visit him and I thought he was the coolest thing ever. So I had to write a song about him.
So Life of the Party, what is that, like your third?
It was our third.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now this is not only is this the album where you're getting more success, but I think you're really seeing your sound coming together and gelling by this point.
Well, we didn't know how to play our instruments when we first started. So, you know, I just picked up guitar literally 6 months, maybe, well, not quite, but I mean, you know, 18 months before the first album came out, you know, I was in a garage band. They were bad. They were bad because of me, you know, they weren't bad because,
but there's a few things I want to ask you about. There's a couple things that I think are pretty consistent with Planet Smashers. The first is that you sort of maintain that like two-tone mid-tempo speed for the most part. You don't really go crazy fast.
Yeah.
And you don't get like super punky either. I mean, it's a punk flavor to it, but it's really more in like a two-tone style.
There's a fifth rule.
What's the fifth rule?
There's a fifth rule. Don't make them break their legs. This is like what our bass player would always say. He'd be like, you're in the groove. You can't just change the groove like that. You know, you got to keep it going. Don't make the fans break their legs while they're dancing.
So, I like that.
And that really influenced our songwriting. It was, you know, get in the groove and kind of stick with it, you know. And, it is to some extent, you could say, if you listen to the Planet Smashers and you're not really into the band, you might say, oh, well, everything sounds the same. But, you know, that's true. but the variations are there. But we had certain reasons for why we stuck to what we did. And we wanted to have the dance party going right through. We want people to dance and not throw them off. And
yeah, I actually think that this kind of is what helps your record and other people that did this kind of as well, like stand the test of time. Because I think in the 90s, it made a lot of sense as a young band to try to throw as much genres and tempos into your songs. But I think that's hasn't aged as well as just saying like, we're going to write a good dance record and sort of stick with this groove and this tempo.
Well, that was the goal. I mean, maybe at the time we didn't think about the other side, but we're coming from that era of when, you know, the Clash was a huge influence on my songwriting. It still is. And everything I do, it's kind of boring these days because a lot of people say that, but it really has impacted me in so many ways. I mean, I could say my entire musical preference is summed up in one guitar solo by the Clash, Tommy Gunn. I think it's four notes, maybe it's three notes. It's not even a solo, but I call it a solo. But that pretty much embodies every way, my way of thinking when it comes to music. And that is, you know, write a song. If you're doing a solo, it doesn't have to be a solo. It can just be part of the song, you know, and it fits the moment. And you're in a band, you're not there to, you know, at times, yes, you need to shine. I get it. And that's great when a particular musician in a band shines and it elevates the song, but it has to elevate the song if you're going to take up that space. So keep things simple. And there'll be times when it makes sense. And other times, you know, don't do that. You know, just stay in the groove. Write songs.
The other thing about the band, but particularly, you know, starting with this record, is the horns are really good. They sound good. They're doing interesting parts that have some technical aspect to it. And they're not, you know, they don't sound like, you know, they're not even like slightly off a little bit. I mean, they sound really precise.
Yeah, they were great.
I mean, I just think that's a thing that you listen to and it's like, wow, this horn section is above average for other ska bands.
The saxophone player that was in the band, he was only in briefly, and he was such a talent. His name was Aaron. He was so good, but touring did not go well with him. He just lost his mind and he was like, I have to quit. And it made perfect sense. Like the last time he was in the band, he was throwing up black liquid, and he hadn't had a coffee in a long time. Like something was really, like, it just didn't go well with him. But he was such a talent. And you know, you'd get stuck in a song. You know what that's like, Adam? You're stuck in a moment and you're like, where's the song going? I need to fix this. It's not quite working. He would come in and be like, bing, and you'd be saved.
Yeah.
So having someone like that come in, he'd be a great producer if he was still doing music. I think he went into bottled water.
Hopefully he's bringing that to his bottled water job.
There it is. But at the same time, we were also working with Chris Murray on that record. So he also had, he was very, you know, he wanted things to be pretty tight and, well, to be tight. So you can hear that on there too. You could hear his voice on quite a few songs too, singing backup, because we weren't very good at singing and Chris was very good at singing.
Yes.
So he came in, he would try to make me do stuff. I remember him just going, oh, at the console. And he stuck through it. He got us out. He did made us do our things. That album wouldn't have been as good without Chris, I'll tell you right now.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
This episode is brought to you by Mubi, a curated streaming service dedicated to elevating great cinema from around the globe. From iconic directors to emerging auteurs, there was always something new to discover. With Mubi, each and every film is hand-selected, so you can explore the best of cinema, streaming anytime, anywhere. Like Pavements, Alex Ross Perry's rockumentary biopic hybrid about the only band that matters, Pavement. Starring members of the band, as well as Joe Keery, Jason Schwartzman, and Tim Heidecker, the wildly original picture tackles the mythology of the band, their anticipated comeback, and more in a fashion that matches their left-field ethos. To stream Pavements and other great films, you can try Mubi free for 30 days at mubi.com/COS. That's mubi.com/COS for a month of great cinema for free. This episode is brought to you by Mubi, presenting the new film, Lurker. The razor-sharp directorial debut from The Bear and Beef writer-producer Alex Russell, the film follows 20-something Los Angeles retail clerk and loner Matthew, who encounters Oliver, a rising pop star, and takes the opportunity to edge his way into the in crowd. But staying there isn't easy. Hailed by IndieWire as a transfixing tale of LA obsession gone awry, and by Vogue as one of the best movies of the year, Lurker is an exhilarating take on the music industry, the blurred line between friend and fan, and our universal search for validation. Lurker is now streaming exclusively on Mubi. To stream Lurker and other great films, you can try Mubi for free for 30 days at mubi.com/COS. That's mubi.com/COS for a month of great cinema for free.
So you got some interest, some major label interest from the success of this record?
Yeah, we did. We got a few offers from Canadian, what do you want to call it, sub-labels of Warner and Sony. And I think back then it was actually EMI. Wow, my brain farted. I can remember names. EMI. EMI was probably the most interested.
Did you get any good offers?
They were pretty good. But see, the thing is, I ran Stomp Records, so I knew how much we were getting when we sold 25,000 albums. You know, I knew what we were getting. And all of a sudden, I'm like, wait a minute. That's how are we going to sustain all this stuff that we do if we're not getting that? And yeah, are we going to sell four times the number of records if we sign to a major? Maybe, but we never found out. Maybe that was a mistake.
so you just felt like it was a better business decision to keep everything in house.
Yeah, it was also right around the time. So we're probably 2000, right around 2000, and Moon started having problems. And I remember talking to them, and you know, Brett, who worked there for years, he said, Matt, let me tell you, you know, our biggest mistake is that we pushed Scott. We didn't push the bands. We didn't. And I was like, oh my God, we did that too. Oh no, quick, start pushing the bands. So things were changing and we were scared. We were scared of what would happen if we gave away that control to a major. And you know, it was a scary little moment in Stomp Records and also for the Smashers. We were doing well, but we were, I guess you could say, slightly afraid. So maybe we should have signed to a major. We didn't. We still did fine. I don't think we'd be around if we had signed to a major. So
Yeah. Walk us through a little bit this period of time between. So Moon Records is going bankrupt. And then, you know, a few years later, you guys have the success with Bedouin Soundclash and Flatlanders and all that. So kind of walk us through what's going on in this period of time leading up to that.
We were still spending like things were fine. So we're still putting good money into records. We opened a record store with Fred Perry in it and Ben Sherman's because no one had it and cool ska music. So that was a bit of a distraction. Didn't realize how much money it was losing. Whatever. And then Moon went down and Cargo, our Canadian distributor, also started having trouble in about 2003. This combined with the fact that Jordan Swift, who started the label with me, didn't want to do it anymore. So right around 2000, 2001, all these sort of little red flags are popping up. And what are we going to do? Actually, I think Cargo went bankrupt in 2001 as well. So when a distributor goes bankrupt, it's not a good thing. So Cargo, you know, they had, I don't know, 15, 20,000 albums of ours in that we thought were sold. So we lost that income. And then similarly with Moon got screwed over by their distributor, which was Caroline Distribution at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it just wiped them out and they couldn't pay their bills. I mean, they tried. Brett was like, bring your van down, fill it up with whatever ska you want. Just take whatever you want. I mean, we have so much extra stock. Just come get it. I actually got some King Apparatus, like a couple hundred King Apparatus, which I gave back to Chris. But, you know, they tried to do what they could, but financially, everyone was out, you know. And that combined with what we were actually doing in the city, which was we had this store that wasn't doing well that we thought was awesome. And Smashers were in studio doing No Self-Control, spending a lot of money. This is before we knew about Canadian grants as well. They were there. We just didn't know about them.
Oh, wow.
oops.
That's a bummer.
Wait, so did you start getting grants?
Not yet. It took a bit. We didn't have them yet. We were still unaware that they existed.
Tell me, explain real briefly the grants and then when you started to utilize them.
The Canadian, so there's a couple of programs up here. The biggest one's called Factor for Anglophone music. That would be, it supports the development of young artists primarily. So it'll give you seed money. So if you want to go do an album, you send in an application and you say, we're going to spend $10,000. Can you give us, you know, three? And they'll give you two or something. But they would make the project happen. And then it would extend. They developed their programs to include tour support. So, you know, they would help you if your tour was in a deficit. They would pony up so that you didn't actually lose money. Video production, that actually was just free money because that went right back to the TV and the video industry. And it also helped Canadian content because we have Canadian content regulations up here without any content.
Yeah, they have to have a certain amount that is Canadian and not just American stuff, basically, right?
Internet, effectively, yeah, because we just didn't have the content. It didn't exist. So that was funded through not just Factor. It's not just public funding. That was actually coming through the private sector as well, because, you know, things like Much Music and even, you know, any sort of radio station to get their license, they needed Canadian content because it didn't exist. Right. To meet the standards, they were like, there's no content. We can't meet these standards. We're going to play the same five videos every day. You know, so they would actually put money into it as well. And that's where our first grant as a band came from, the private sector one, which was actually Surfing into Fino. So we weren't into Factor yet, but our very first project that was supported by government money or by private sector money at that time was Surfing into Fino, which shows because we obviously flew out to Fino. We're on the beach, hanging out, having a good time. You know, it was a real production, but we didn't know about it for album recording. So off we went back. It was probably 4 years later before we figured out how to get access to help us with funding for recorded music. And that was Mighty. When we put out Mighty, that album was funded significantly by that program.
Interesting.
Which was great.
Yeah.
I mean, you listen to that album, the sound quality is so good. But that's because we had, I think, close to 5 weeks in the studio.
Wow.
you know, we weren't lining our pockets. It's all going right back into the into the economy.
But so. 5 weeks in the studio, what a luxury.
Yeah. Unbelievable. Sometimes we just tune guitars. There was a lot of like not a lot. There was moments of putzing around, like just what is this gonna sound like? Let's put a microphone up against the window. Well, let's put a microphone up against the toilet. just random stuff. Oh, it sounds bad. Okay. But that had a big impact. It still did. I mean, a lot of the pop punk stuff that came out of Canada, that you know, some 41, Simple Plan, to name a few, a lot of that came from that program. Factor, yep. You know, made that happen. Even to this day, you probably wouldn't know who Patrick Watson is if it wasn't for some of these developmental grant programs. You know, right now it's a little, they're not as lucrative as they used to be because the private sector has sort of had to pull out because they don't have advertisement anymore. But they're still there. They're still super influential. There are some barriers for Canadian artists getting into America that, well, you know, you just walked right in with a contract and playing shows.
Paid $24 in tax Canadian.
There you go.
To bring our
which is GST.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty good. You know, there's no withholding for you. When we play in the States, 30% of our guarantee goes poof, just like that.
Wow.
Just goes straight to the IRS. And we have to pay about $3,000 to get into the country. It's even worse for European bands. The rates just went up. Like, it's like, it can be like 10 grand for a UK band to get into the States now.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are some reasons, there's other reasons why these programs exist, and they were trying to level the playing field a little bit.
I want to talk a little bit more about your guys' relationship to touring in the US. But before that, on this conversation we have about you guys kind of surviving this period in the early 2000s, you made a distribution deal with Warner Brothers. Can you tell me a little bit about that and when that happened and how that worked out?
We were, after Cargo went down, we struggled a bit. We went with a couple independent distributors for a little while that didn't really work out. And then we signed, we had the Belvedere album. We knew we had Unstoppable coming up. We knew we had Flatliners Destroy to Create. And we also knew about Sounding Mosaic. So we're 2004 at this time. We're like, we have these albums coming out. We think they can do well. The bands are doing well. We need something better. So we went and talked to Warner in Toronto. And at the time, the president of Warner was a super cool cat. His name was Steve Kane. And he picked us up. He did it. He said, let's go. He said, do you want an advance? And we're like, nope, we don't need anything, which we did at the time, but we didn't want to seem needy. We were very close to going out of business right around that time. I mentioned that we had a store for a while. We had a manager who ran it. He ran it very well, but he didn't realize that the invoices he was getting needed to, you know, they were going to his store, needed to be, you know, she needed to share that information with us. So we didn't pay all these bills. We had a nice six-figure deficit, which was a lot for us because we were just, you know, nobody's having a good time. But signing with Warner really changed things. It opened up a lot of doors for us in Canada in particular, and also quite a few in the States, because when something was successful like Bedouin Sound Clash, we were able to use Warner's contacts to reach out and find partners, which is where Side One Dummy came in.
I see. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay. So with the US, are you the Canadian ska band that has toured the US the most?
Yes.
I feel like yes is the answer. Okay.
Oh yeah.
My Bedouin has played a fair amount, but I think you guys have done more.
I don't think Bedouin would call themselves ska though. I don't mean they are. Maybe they...
Well, we're calling them ska.
Yeah. They get called ska by us.
Good. Bedouin, ska. What do you think, Jay?
We claim them.
They did the show, so.
Oh, good.
Ska. And they're the new record they did a couple years ago, pretty heavily ska, yeah.
It's more ska than ever, yeah.
But still, you've toured the U.S. even more than them, right?
I think so. Yeah. They would be close. I mean, like, yeah, we definitely toured more. We had a decade before they even got in there, so.
When did you start touring the U.S.?
95, but not a lot. We just poked down to the Northeast occasionally. We started playing with Big D, like going, probably the first time was 96. We played with the Allstonians back there in Cambridge fairly often. They were sort of our little weekend buddies. But Big D, probably 96, 97 maybe. I think we started playing with them a fair bit.
Okay.
And then Mustard Plug almost 95, started playing with them. So whipping down to Detroit and playing their New Year's Eve shows type thing. But it wasn't extensive touring. The extensive touring really kicked in 2000.
Okay.
Yeah.
So from 2000 to 2010, that was a really extensive period of touring in the U.S.?
I mean, I would cut it at 2008, I'd say. That's where we kind of stopped. But yeah, we were down there a lot.
Now, when we talked about this a little bit about the cost of coming down to play, did you guys always cross the legit or did you ever try sneaking in?
Oh, no, we always snuck over in the olden days. You sneak over. You'd be able to show, you do, back in the olden days, you could say, oh, I'm recording.
Yes. Show them a shitty fake contract.
You know, I got Steve Foote's letter from Fork in Hand Records and we're going to go record an album.
Yeah.
And they'd say, well, what's your band called? Planet Smashers. You know, they'd be like, never heard of you. You look more like the Cockroaches or something. And off you'd go. You know, you take it and they'd make sure you're being, you know, good little tourist. And it was simple.
Did you ever get dinged at the border?
We got in. The problems we ran into was, 2004?
Yeah.
I think it was 2004 Warped Tour. Mm. We're on Warped Tour. And, you know, our guys like their weed and they're smoking weed in the parking lot in Virginia. It was the bus parking. And, you know, just two cops came up and said, hey, what you guys doing? Long story short, one guy took the fall for it. Actually, two guys took the fall for it. And they had to go do the whole, you know, criminal case court thing down in Virginia. They did it. They went down. One guy paid his fine. They got it lowered to a demeanor, to like a possession of paraphernalia or something. The other guy didn't pay his fine. He just was like, ah, we're good. We're not guilty. And that fine eventually triggered and he never paid it. And then eventually he got blacklisted from America. That would be good old Dave Cooper. My friend, my lifetime friend who can't play in America. We tried to clear him, but it's just not gonna, it was too much.
Dang, over some weed.
Yeah. Tiny bit of weed. And he should have, if he had just paid that fine, it would have been fine. But for whatever reasons he didn't. And
Damn.
He couldn't go back to America. So that was our biggest problem. We would try to enter the States again. And many times we'd have difficulties. I mean, we got the whole, I've had it. I've had that search. That's anybody in there? Let's take a look. search. Yeah. So, but since then it's been better. Right through, I think, for us, a point like we were getting tired touring. I think 2007, we had a bunch of shows with Rancid and we were heading down to the Detroit border because it had looped up and played Montreal and Toronto to tour. And we're going in to Detroit to play a sold out show at St. Andrew's Hall with Rancid. I mean, my God, this would be great. And of course we couldn't get in because of the old 2004, situation.
Mm.
So we were disallowed. And that actually was one reason why the band stopped touring. Like we just were like, this isn't worth it anymore. We're getting harassed by the cops and by the border guards and it took away the fun.
Yeah.
And that's kind of why we went on a bit of a hiatus for a few years.
I thought I'd heard, that you guys were like specifically banned from playing the US for like 5 years or something.
Well, it was supposed to be only 5 years. After 5 years, you're allowed to apply for entry to America, but it's a temporary pre-arranged entry.
Oh no.
And it takes about 6 months to get those things. And it costs 500 US plus you got to pay for your legal fees. So probably about 2000 US. At that point, it's just like, you know, you're going down, you're in the Planet Smashers. You might be at that point, maybe making 750 a show, maybe 500. Well,
yeah.
The economics weren't there. So we actually had, that's kind of when Andy, who is our current bass player, and he's been in the band for a long time now. He started playing with us as early as 2010, I think was his first appearance. And it's because of our problems getting into the States with Dave that he started playing. And also Dave was scared of flying. So Andy did all of our European touring and all of our fly-ins and also all of our American stuff from 2010 onwards.
Was your song UPS of America about all of this?
It was exactly that. I mean, we thought we're going to be back into it. It's happening. We're finally getting back in. And that was, 2011? Mm-hmm. That album?
Yeah.
That's a good sounding song. And that's our old saxophone player. He had moved back to America at the time. He was American. Because, you know, the band stopped playing and he was a full-time musician. He ended up joining Mephistopheles for a while. And I think he's still playing a bit with them. But anyway, he's the border guard in that recording. It's a good one. I don't think we've ever played it live.
You got to play that one when you're doing this some U.S. shows this year.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I'll talk to the guys. Guys, what do you say?
Yeah.
Yeah, they'll be all for it. I'll be like, damn it.
Now, so you're doing Supernova this year, and I've seen you got some other dates in the U.S. this year, right? Yep.
We're doing Supernova. We're doing the Denver Ska Festival, which will be a lot of fun. Finally get to play with Joystick, a band that's been on Stomp in some variations for years, but they can't get into Canada very easily. Now they can, but long story short, they couldn't at the time. I haven't played with them in years. We played with them in Atlanta probably in, I don't know, 2000 and something. But it'd be good to play with them. We're doing that. We're doing Supernova. We're doing some dates leading up to Supernova with Suicide Machines and a bunch of other awesome bands. And we're doing Fest for the first time in October, which will be a lot of fun. I think we're teaming with Big D for a couple shows around that. And Musterbrook will be down there too. And of course, the Flatliners will be there as well. So it's going to be a good time. I'll be running around doing high fives.
Are we going to get Flatliners to do ska down at Fest?
Oh, they should.
They were supposed to do it the last time, because they played on the ska stage like 2 years ago and they didn't do it. They chickened out. Well, I think it was because one of their guitar players couldn't make it. So they had somebody from Comeback Kid filling in.
Oh, okay.
And trying to get somebody from Comeback Kid to play ska.
To play ska.
Yeah. Happening.
It's very difficult.
Hopefully this time.
Hopefully you can pressure Chris the band
and team
to do the right thing.
Yeah.
I don't think I can pressure them. I can probably beg. Come on, please. They might be doing it for all I know. You know, they might have already have that in their plans.
Yeah, I hope so. We'll just shoot them an email anyways.
Yeah. Come on, Chris.
Now, have you guys, is it been a while since you've played the US?
Because
I feel like you were scheduled for Supernova like the previous year, right?
We were. Yeah, we didn't get it. We played, I think January last year was the last time we were down there. Went down to California, but we were supposed to play a string of dates leading up to Supernova. Our immigration didn't get processed on time. Yeah. We were at 87 days. Normally it only takes about less than 40, but I don't know. I think maybe the summer students came in and just had a hard time processing the immigration.
Yeah.
And we got screwed. We got the welcome letter. You get an email when you gets approved. It's not like welcome to America, but it's a very friendly letter. You know, your work permit's been approved. Congratulations, sort of language. I got that on Wednesday after Supernova. Supernova's over and the letter comes in.
So I
forwarded it to Tim from Supernova to say, come on, give us one more chance. I can get this. I know I can get it. I applied so early this year and it's approved. So we're allowed to come in.
Excellent. Okay. So we can rest assured that you're going to be at Supernova this year.
We're going to be there. It'll be great. I'm so excited. I mean, we went to England for a tour this March. And so many fans over there have been to Supernova, and they so many come. The musicians come, the bands come. It's so international now. I can't wait, and you know, to go see familiar faces in weird parts of the world.
Yeah,
that'll be my first. It's my first fest as well, so that's good.
Hell yeah. Thank you for listening to In Defense of Ska. To support the show, sign up for our Patreon. Intro and outro music by Slo Gherkin from the EP Lives. Additional music by Dan P. and the Bricks. Please rate and review the podcast and tell a friend. Follow at In Defense of Ska on social media. The book In Defense of Ska by Aaron Carnes is available from Clash Books. Order it online. Chris Reeves of SPI is our editor.
This is your co-host, Adam Davis of Omnigon, leaving you by saying ska now more than ever.
Okay, that's it for our conversation with Matt. Hmm. Or is it? Listen, we have a thing called the In Defense of Ska Patreon.
One more.
For only $5 a month, access, or more, you can have access to exclusive content, behind the scenes, we call it behind the curtain. You can have access to the In Defense of Ska Discord. And you'll also be supporting this show. And at a little bit, in, like Aaron said, for a little bit more of your hard-earned money, you can get an In Defense of Ska enamel pin. Mm-hmm. You can get an In Defense of Ska tote bag.
Now, maybe you're thinking to yourself, I like the episodes as they are. I don't need any of this stuff. But you love the podcast. And you like what the podcast does, how we're documenting all these ska bands and we're getting these stories. You too can support the Patreon and help us. We need your help. We are, you know, a small operation and we're putting in a lot of effort and we have some expenses that we need covered. And every little bit that you put into the podcast, it goes deeper and it makes the podcast better and it makes the podcast continue to last. So, ooh, huge sale pitch today. What's going on with that?
Yeah.
I know. It's just, I already feeling did it strong. And then you did it again. Really trying to get them subscribers today.
Crazy.
Let's you want to do it again? Let's beg. Let's start begging people. What do you think?
No. I want to go. I want to go.
All right,
Scott. No, I'm scared. I want to go.